Hey, man, how's it going, guys? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm tweeting things here, man. I'm tweeting. Anyway, whatever. It's my show. I hate the government. I hate it so much, and especially the wars and stuff. So that's why I do the show, so that I try to influence you to also hate it as much as I do. And then, once all 300 million something of us hate it as much as I do, then we won't have it anymore. And then we'll be free. The wars will be over, and it'll be great. That's my plan. I'm sticking to it. I know that I won't have accomplished it by the time I'm dead, but, you know, whatever, you do what you can. Anyway, so, yeah. Today on the show, man, Scott Paul is from Oxfam, and he's going to be on to talk about Barack Obama starving the Yemenis to death. Starving the Yemenis to death. Guess which ones die first? Right, the kids. And the elderly. So that's happening on the show today. Also, Christian Appy is going to be back on the show. Talked with him before about Vietnam, I think. I know I talked with him one time about something. I know he wrote a book about Vietnam that I have but haven't read yet. But anyway, he's going to be on to talk about Hiroshima in America. To borrow a phrase from Greg Mitchell. This article, he wrote a great article for Tom Dispatch about how Americans perceive the nuclear attacks all these 70 years later. Well, and since then, you know. And why they believe the things that they believe. It's interesting stuff. And I'll tell you something else about Tom Dispatch. He's got another piece that's running today. It's on antiwar.com today as well. And it is called Under the Mushroom Cloud, Nagasaki After Nuclear War. Yeah, you got to read that one, man. It's by Susan Southard. It's a book excerpt telling the personal stories of survivors of the Nagasaki attack. Holy crap, man. It's really something else. You got to take a look at that. It's running today on antiwar.com. Unfortunately, Brad Hoff cannot be here today because of prior obligations, but I'm going to have him on the show Monday for you to talk about Michael Flynn, the head of the DIA and all that. I'll probably cover that story for you anyway here today because it's so important. You might have heard a little bit of it in the Con Hallinan interview yesterday. All right. So I guess, actually, I'm really glad that I only have two guests today because I have so much news to get to. I'm sorry. I wanted to get somebody on to talk about Fallujah. I haven't had a single person on the Iraq War this week, have I? The last one was Patrick Coburn. I think. So sorry about that. I'll get back to there's a battle for Fallujah going on. I'll cover it for you here on the show myself, but I prefer to have better, I forgot. I was distracted reading a tweet and I don't remember what the hell I was talking about. Okay. Let me just say this real quick, man. I'm glad I only got 5 minutes before the segment's over. So, I can just say this real quick and be done with it. Rand Paul still sucks. First debate last night. And I don't know what is the matter with me that I'm so flawed that I was still holding out hope that he was going to decide finally that actually being good on stuff would be his only saving grace. We know you know the words, Rand. Just say them. But no. What a disappointment. And even when he says, oh, we're financing ISIS's enemies. Like, that's as close as he got, or ISIS's allies. That's as close as he got to saying something right. But even then, it wasn't quite right. I mean, ISIS and al-Nusra are at odds. If he understood what he was talking about and explained it well at all, He could have explained, well, they're de facto allies anyway. We're helping them in their goal of overthrowing the government in Damascus. But it's kind of, it doesn't actually, you know, hold up. I'm sure the fact checkers got him. They're like, well, look. I mean, in fact, he even said, yeah, they're driving around in our Humvees. But the U.S. government didn't give ISIS the Humvees. They stole the Humvees from the Iraqi army. The Shiite army that's fighting ISIS, only not very well, and withdrew and left all their equipment behind. What they got from America was a bunch of guns and a bunch of money and probably a bunch of Toyota trucks that they stole from the so-called Free Syrian Army. Bunch of supplies, some TOW missiles. Much less equipment has been supplied to the Syrian rebels this whole time. Where they got the Humvees was in sacking Mosul and sacking Ramadi. So here's the one thing where he got right and he's saying something controversial, but he still just steps all over himself and screws it up. Like that time that he said John McCain is friends with ISIS. No, he's not. He's friends with the Northern Storm Brigade, and they're friends with ISIS. They sold Stephen Sotloff to ISIS. And, in fact, their leader was a veteran of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So those are all horrible, horrible, horrible things to say about John McCain's friends and John McCain. But no, steps on his own dick, screws it up. Last night, his first question, I think it was his first question of the night. You have said before that GOP hawks are partially to blame for the rise of ISIS. How so? And he said, no, they're not. Only ISIS is responsible for ISIS. Only ISIS is responsible for their brutality and terrorism. And immediately, I mean, as he was saying the words, the tweet went out. Right? So he had all, they weren't quoting him. It was simultaneous that he had practiced that if anybody asks you whether the Republicans ever did anything wrong in American foreign policy, the answer is, let me screw up my oversimplified explanation of what's happening in Syria only. But Iraq War II, never heard of it. Even Libya. I think maybe he mentioned Libya, but he certainly didn't explain the context. And he certainly, and then he said, yeah, and I say we got to defeat ISIS by, you know, not financing their allies anymore. All right. So, accept their premise of what must be done and then announce that you'll refuse to, obviously, you'll refuse to do what it takes to carry out your agreed upon goals. And then Donald Trump stole the line from him. Later on, he just interrupted in the middle of another question or another answer and said, by the way, I was right about Iraq. I warned that we shouldn't do Iraq War II. I said it would destabilize the whole region. And none of these clowns listen to me. Oh, for Christ's sake, that was Rand Paul's line. Right? My father opposed the war. I agreed with him back then in 03 when he said that this will destabilize the region. But the hawks didn't listen, and look what they did. And look, guys, I mean, it's at tomwoods.com/blog. It's on Tom Woods' Facebook page. I wrote an entire set of talking points for Rand to help him explain. Don't tell me he didn't see it was on, or that he at least didn't hear of such a thing. It was on Tom Woods' Facebook, and it got 700 shares or something. Here's what you say, Rand. It's all true. It's just kind of trying to, you know, say it in a recitable way. He lets Trump be the anti-war guy. And he spends the rest of the time attacking Trump for being an outsider, not being a Republican Party man enough, not swearing his fealty to the party enough. Yeah, great look, Rand. Oh, and then he lied about the Iran deal again, too.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and you might have seen that there was this video that was released the other day by a Japanese news station that was footage of Truman in Japan in, I think, 1962 or something like that, lying his ass off, excusing the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. His guests are being very gracious. Here, and, our good friend Jeremy cleaned up the audio for us in a, almost, to a, almost magical degree, if you heard the original.
The objective was to end a war.
Oh, why is it so quiet? Whoops. Why is my VLC player all the way down?
The objective was to end a war in such a way that there would not be half a million people killed on each side and that many injured from then on. And that's all there was to it. You know when you're...
Hey, that's all there was to it. We're trying to save the lives of half a million men on each side. George H.W. Bush once claimed a million Americans were scheduled to die in the invasion of mainland Japan. The actual army study estimated 40,000. Someone tweeted to me yesterday that MacArthur's estimate was only 10,000. And anyway, you trade half a million women and children for half a million GIs? Is this the USA or Germany? Is this the USA or Japan? Who, you know, Tojo, I guess, would have been glad to kill a few hundred thousand civilians in order to save 10 or 50,000 Japanese soldiers. But so, does that make Truman Tojo? Or just not because he's from west of there? Anyway, well, of course he's got to lie. Just like Rand Paul has to lie about the Iran deal to justify opposing the Iran deal. Hey, Harry Truman has to lie about nuking Japan. Always, just like in the right-wing cranks in my Twitter feed, always these guys refuse, absolutely refuse to even address the condition of unconditional surrender. When the Japanese had been suing for peace and clearly only wanted to keep the emperor. Then after their unconditional surrender, MacArthur let them keep the emperor anyway. But why did it have to be an unconditional surrender? So that we can make the rest of our pro-nuke argument. That's why. That's the only reason why. You'll never even hear that part debated. This right-wing crank I was arguing with in my Twitter feed, I kept saying to him over and over and over, address the demand for unconditional surrender. Nuh-uh. The Japanese only understand force. Oh, God. You only apparently understand nothing at all. You know, once you decide you're a nationalist, once you've been to fifth grade government school and they tell you that of course you side with your heroic President Harry Truman, who made the important decision to do the important thing to end the war and save the lives. Now, someone's trying to tell you that you've been a damned fool your whole life to believe that madness, the kind of crap that Joseph Goebbels might have crammed up your ass? Nope, it's easier to just keep believing it than to recognize what a damned fool you've been, apparently. Oh, change my mind about something. I don't know if I can. What do you mean the Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months? I don't want to learn anything more about that. All right, anyway. By the way, where the hell is it? I lost it. I had somewhere the great list of quotes, but I don't need them. I'll just tell you. Admiral Leahy, who was Truman's chief of staff, Ike Eisenhower, who was the commander of the United Nations forces in Europe, MacArthur and Nimitz, the competitive admirals fighting the Pacific War, and many more. Names that aren't quite as much household names. King and Hill and Bobby and whatever, the rest of them. Dozens of them. Of the contemporary military commanders said this is absolutely not necessary. It was not necessary to hit them with that awful thing, said Ike Eisenhower, the communist traitor, sissy sellout, right? And MacArthur said it was unnecessary. Curtis LeMay, who had burnt Tokyo to the ground, said they would have given up within a couple of weeks. The war was over, man. Who said America needed to invade him, even insisting on unconditional surrender? We still had total dominance over the air and the sea at that point. Their Navy and Air Force were gone. So, yeah, Curtis LeMay thought it was unnecessary, right? Curtis LeMay, who would have been happy to start a nuclear war with the Soviet Union when he knew good and well that America would have gotten nuked off the face of the earth, too. That lunatic thought it was quite unnecessary to nuke Japan. Oh, no, but your dad and Uncle Dave are right that, hey, Truman did what he absolutely had to do. Because, hey, they went to government school, and their teacher went to government school, and their parents went to government school. And the government says that the government had to do that thing that if the Nazis had done it, it would have been a Nazi thing to do. If the Japanese had done it, it would have been an Imperial Japanese thing. Can you believe those dastardly Imperial Japanese using atomic weapons on people? No wonder we had to go to war against them. Would be the argument. Oh, but whatever. Hey, if you were born somewhere between San Diego and Bangor, Maine, then you have to be on America's side no matter what, even if it is run by a bunch of Nazis. Because otherwise, what? You'd have to think about it for a minute. Oh, by the way, cost of upgrading U.S. nuclear arsenal estimated at $963 billion. $963 million. Really, $1 million. $1 trillion. Just to keep the nukes we got updated. And you wonder why you can't have nice things. It's the empire. See? It ruins everything. Everything. All right. Later on the show, I got Iran stuff. I got Iraq stuff. I got Palestine. And the police state. I swear, I got a whole list of police state stories we are getting to on the show today. I've been putting it off all week long. Right back with Christian Appy in a sec.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Christian Appy. He is the author of this new book that came out, I think, just earlier this year or late last year, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War, and Our National Identity. And now this piece that he wrote for Tom Dispatch that ran on antiwar.com is along those same lines, only about the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But what it means to us, the article is America's Hiroshima and Nagasaki 70 years later. Welcome back to the show, Christian. How are you?
I'm just doing great. Thanks, Scott, for having me on.
Very happy to have you here and to read what you wrote. So, yeah, and in fact, I was reading this right when I was arguing on Twitter with, you know, ridiculous right-wing nationalist about the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all the important points dodged by him, which, to be fair, is probably because he'd never been confronted with any of them before. Like, who said unconditional surrender was holy writ and absolutely non-negotiable? Why did it have to be that way? And even if we did accept the premise of unconditional surrender, why do we have to invade the place? Why couldn't we do like the Brits and just lay siege forever or whatever? Mm-hmm. You know, these kinds of things. Forget all that. Just whatever. It ended the war, and the war was ended, and so we won. And what else do you need to know, really, Christian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that the justifications for the atomic bombing of Japan, I think, remain one of the most deeply embedded, what I would call legitimizing narratives of American policy in our history. It's amazing how long it lasts, and as based as it is on many distortions, omissions, and flat-out fabrications. You know, the thing that I find more troubling is the idea that not only did it end the war in a way that made it absolutely necessary, is this idea that it was somehow merciful, a kind of mercy killing, because the assumption is that had we not done it, we inevitably would have had to attack and invade the home islands at a cost of hundreds of thousands of lives on both sides. And indeed, you know, that number keeps trickling upward over the 70 years since then. And now you even hear at one point in 1991, President George H.W. Bush claimed that it spared millions of lives. And this, of course, is untestable. We can't replay history, right? So we don't know if there ever would have been a land invasion or how many people might have died. But the numbers that Truman was actually getting while he was president from military panel of experts was around 40,000 American dead, assuming that we had to invade. It was scheduled for November 1st, and you know, 3 months after the war ended. And then the second invasion was scheduled for March of the next year. And by that point, most top American military commanders believed that the Japanese were already effectively defeated. I'm talking about six of the seven five-star American generals and admirals all agreed that the war was effectively over. And again, we don't know whether they would have surrendered on different terms, but that's certainly an alternative that could have been pursued, as you mentioned. Why not change the demand for unconditional surrender and allow the emperor to stay on the throne, which is in fact exactly the concession that Truman offered after killing more than 250,000 civilians with those atomic bombs.
And it was clear, wasn't it, before then that that was their only condition?
Yeah, I mean, listen, there were debates, you know, within government and, you know, but I think if we had cracked the code, so we knew they were talking to Russia and other people about the possibility of unconditional surrender, it is at least something worth exploring. And Truman himself, interestingly enough, seemed open to the idea of it as late as June of that summer when he
of conditional surrender.
Of allowing the emperor to stay on. Joseph Grew, who was then the Secretary of State, was pushing it, and Truman, considering it. And then once the Trinity test, that is to say, the first successful experiment, you know, the dropping of the bomb out in the desert of New Mexico, once that proves successful, from that point on, Truman seems like locked in on his determination to use those bombs, despite the fact that his own Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, was also pressing him right up to the last minute to drop the insistence on unconditional surrender.
Mm. And now Stimson was, I think, the one or the highest member of the cabinet to agree with Truman on using the nukes, right?
Well, he backed in. Yeah, he, at the end, came on board and then even wrote a very influential article a couple of years later defending the decision. So he was one of these classic team players.
But he had no
he had his own
before.
Reservations about that. And, you know, a more important advisor to Truman was this conservative South Carolina James Burns, who became his Secretary of State, who was whispering in his more than whispering, saying, "You know, Mr. President, not only will we end the war by dropping these weapons and therefore, quote unquote, save lives," he was really saying, "We can make the Soviet Union more manageable in Europe by demonstrating this colossal power because we're the only country to have it," and it would also, by the way, prevent the Soviet Union from making a greater claim on territory in the Far East, because Stalin had pledged to come into the war against Japan back in the spring. He said, "I will come into the war against Japan within 90 days after the end of the war in Europe." And he was good on that. He actually did enter the war on August 8th, 2 days after the bombing of Hiroshima, and was racing across Manchuria at great loss of life to the Japanese, so that some historians, this one particular historian in Japan, is now arguing that the Japanese actually were as induced to surrender because of the Soviet entrance into the war as they were from the nuclear weapons. So it's not even clear that actually it was the nuclear weapons that really was most important in ending the war.
Yeah. All right. Now, if you could you go back to the, not just the list, and I'd like to hear the list, but the context. Paint a picture then of just who all in the military chain of command in, you know, I guess they didn't have the National Security Council then, but I know that Admiral Leahy was the chief of staff. So
yeah,
that
was
a pretty
one.
Damn important position there.
Absolutely. And unfortunately,
so there was a real, like, yeah. let the audience understand who in D.C. or who in the War Department really thought it needed to be used or opposed it and how much and that kind of thing. Because I think this part of the story is what's really impressive, the thing that they never mentioned to us in fifth grade when they teach it the first time.
Yeah, I would say the one person that did support Truman in using it was George Marshall. He obviously a very famous general from the period, and you know the Marshall Plan is named after him and so forth. But once beyond that, what's extraordinary, Douglas MacArthur, as it turned out, was not shy about advocating nuclear bombing during the Korean War. He wanted to nuke China, but at the time in 1945. He actually believed that it was completely unnecessary. He didn't have moral objections to it, but he really thought that American forces, those brave American sailors and soldiers, had really already effectively defeated Japan. So too did Dwight David Eisenhower. And he, like Admiral Leahy, who you mentioned, not only did the two of them think it was militarily unnecessary, those two actually had moral objections as well. Leahy described it as an act of barbarism and, against all the sort of Christian ethics that he believed in and laws of war. And Eisenhower himself wished that we hadn't used it. Just before World War II, in America, many people thought the bombing of urban populations, civilian populations, was the utter act of inhumanity. And Franklin Roosevelt, actually, on the first day of the war, September 1st, 1939, gave an eloquent speech attacking the barbarism and wishing that no one would use it. Now, once it started happening, World War II, we quickly joined in on it and became the biggest bomber of civilian populations by the end, not just the atomic bombs, but we need to remember that we firebombed 67 Japanese cities.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Christian Appy on nuking Hiroshima and what it means to Americans today. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Christian Appy. He is a professor of history at the University of Massachusetts and is the author of 3 books about Vietnam, including the most recent, American Reckoning, the Vietnam War, and Our National Identity. We're talking about nuking Hiroshima and, well, we're really supposed to be talking about what all it means to Americans. And so we've been talking about all the excuses and how bogus they are. Oh, whoops, I forgot. Let me play this for you real quick. This is just newly unearthed audio from actually a video of Harry Truman in Japan in, I believe, 1962 or 68 or something like that, and excusing himself for nuking them and, of course, lying like Rand Paul in order to do so. So here it goes.
The objective was to end a war in such a way that there would not be 500,000 people killed on each side and that many injured from then on. And that's all it was. You know, when you're running a war,
yes,
the objective is to win it.
There you go. Hey, when you're running a war, the objective is to win it. So I guess if the Nazis had used nukes on all the Jews and Slavs all the way to the Bering Sea, that would have been okay, as long as it was because they were trying to win the war, man, right? And that's the only measure of morality. Or maybe that's only if you're from the middle part of North America. Then you get to kill whoever you want and use whatever excuse you want. But there's an important point here beyond just my blabbing and cursing about Truman. And it's something that you mentioned earlier. I forgot exactly how you said it, but it was sort of along the lines of how important this sacrifice of the Japanese, not of ourselves, this sacrifice of Japanese civilians is in America's civic religion. And I've long maintained that instead of Washington and Jefferson, that it's FDR and Truman who are the founders of the modern American empire, the founding fathers of it. And we've really kind of replaced Washington and the cherry tree and Abraham Lincoln and the slaves and those previous civic myths with America as Superman, like that one time that we saved the French from the Nazis and this kind of thing. And, you know, they even portray Libya. Any war that they do is always like that time we saved the French from the Nazis. And World War II is that kind of foundational thing. And so that explains, I think, to a large part, I think that's part of what you're trying to say in this article, why people refuse to just be honest about this for a minute. You know, hey, Zora Neale Hurston was right. He's the butcher of Asia. Why is that so hard to say? And it's not because of the actual act. It's because of what all it means for the American empire and how our goodness defines evil things as good things when we're the ones carrying them out and all this that Americans have a lot invested in. Because if nuking Japan was wrong, think of all the other stuff that could have been wrong too then.
Yeah, there seems to just be this undying broad faith that really an American exceptionalism, a key part of which is this idea that we are not more virtuous than other nations, and that we put a higher price on life than other nations, and that because we are so well intentioned, it justifies just about anything we do. I mean, there was, I quote in this article, a moment in 1988, now long forgotten, when the United States Navy in the Persian Gulf shot down an Iranian civilian airliner. And it killed, I think, 290 people, all civilians. 66 children. And George Bush, who then was the vice president running for president, said, and this is a direct quote, "I will never apologize for the United States of America, ever. I don't care what the facts are," right in the aftermath of that shootdown. So it's just, again, as you say, almost anything can be justified so long as we adhere to this notion that we are the indispensable nation, always a force for good in the world, no matter how much it defies the reality, the facts. You don't care what the facts are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because it's especially the conservative nationalists who are always denouncing moral relativism who are the first to say, like Giuliani, when he's asked about, you know, waterboarding being torture, he says, well, it depends on who does it. Yeah. And anything else is moral equivalence.
Yeah.
So, yeah. How dare you?
Right. Well, you know, Karl Rove, a key White House advisor for a few presidents, but most recently George W. Bush, you know, once said that, he admitted it privately the way presidents won't. You know, we're an empire now. We make up our own reality. And you journalists, you know, you reality-based journalists, you'll run around trying to find the facts. And by the time you do, we'll be on to a new story. We can create, it's a direct quote. I mean, we can create our own reality. So, that in a sense, George, the earlier Bush was right. We, you know, whatever, doesn't matter. The facts don't matter. You know, we can make it up.
Yeah.
The bombing of Hiroshima, it's interesting, the emails, I've gotten a lot of emails in response to that article, and they run kind of 50-50, but I've gotten more negative responses to this than anything I think I've really ever written, including some very tough critiques of the Vietnam War. This idea of challenging this idea of American virtue in the so-called, you know, good war. And listen, I believe it was a just war. I'm not a pacifist. I would have supported fighting in World War II. My father was a Marine Corps dive bomber in the Pacific. Though some of the nasty emails to me have said, well, you know, your father might have died and you never would have lived if we hadn't nuked Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So,
yeah. How many women and babies are you willing to kill in order to live?
Well, apparently, as one of these emailers said, I would have killed every one of the Japanese if it would have saved even a few thousand American lives.
See, that's what I appreciate is when people go ahead and just come out and be honest about
it. Yeah.
You know, that what it,
yeah.
And you know what?
Yeah.
A very young person that I know who had just barely heard of such a thing one time asked me, how could that be? I mean, he understood just... it was a bomb big enough to kill a whole city.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, I mean, the truth of it is they looked at the Japanese like they might as well have been from another planet or animals.
Yeah, right.
It's like kicking over an anthill.
Yeah.
There's no limit
forgotten.
To the number of Japs you can burn to death. Who cares? That was the attitude.
It was. I mean, and I do think the most virulent forms of racism have certainly subsided. I mean, there's a Pew poll recently that suggests some real respect among Americans for the Japanese and their culture. So we're not where we were in the 40s, but in the 40s, if you just picked up a Life magazine, you would see the Japanese depicted as monkeys and insects and vermin, and the kindest caricatures had them as sort of buck-toothed, nearsighted cartoon
Yeah, famously,
figures.
Even Dr. Seuss wrote a yes. bunch of cartoons, depicting them as a fifth column waiting to sabotage the United States on orders from Tokyo.
Yeah, actually, right. And we, of course, need to remember that the United States government did order the removal of Japanese Americans, more than half of them American citizens, to the concentration camps away from the California coast, 120,000 of them, which was supported by the Supreme Court.
All right, now real quick here before my last, it's not so much a question but a request. Before that, I just want to mention to the audience again here real quick that Tom Dispatch has run another article about the nuclear bombings. This one is called "Under the Mushroom Cloud," and it's a book excerpt of just telling the stories of survivors of the Nagasaki attack. And you gotta read it, man. And it's at TomDispatch.com, and it's also running today on antiwar.com and under Tom Englehart's name on antiwar.com.
Important new book, yeah.
Yeah, I really hope that people will look at that. I mean, it is really something else, that article. But now, so back to your thing again. Can you talk to me, talk to us a little bit about this movie Unbroken and about the example that you use of the Smithsonian exhibit and what happened to that and what it all means?
Yeah, sure. Just briefly, I was sort of thinking, what's the most popular book about World War II today? And unquestionably, it's been this book and movie, Unbroken. The book itself was on the bestseller list in hardcover for almost 4 years, and it tells a riveting story of this guy, Louis Zapparini, who was a bombardier on a B-24, got shot down, survived 47 days in a lifeboat, and then was captured and brutally tortured in POW camps by the Japanese. So the focus really is on this American survivor who was amazingly resilient. It's incredible that he got through it. But my thought is that nothing in that book gives any indication that the United States had anything to apologize to. And you get this very one-sided view of the sort of monstrous suffering of American soldiers. And, you know, you look at the comments on Amazon and people say, oh, it just increased my appreciation for the American fighting man. And so, you know, I don't really have any problems with the book itself, but it's so skewed toward, you know, thinking about our own experience. So there's that. Yeah. And just compare it to a book that came out way back in 46, the one you mentioned that came out now, Nagasaki, and this book, Hiroshima by John Hersey, that came out the year after the bombing in 46, which gives a very empathic view of the survivors. Mm. So I raise that subject just to show how still in our culture we're just not ready yet to really take on the moral reckoning with our bombing.
Uh-huh. And let me add to that part too, right there, real quick, about just how simple that level of propaganda is, in a way where, you know, that's like junior high school kid stuff, where there was a plane crash, 3 Americans were killed. And mm-hmm. everybody else, they kind of matter a little bit less. Like, that can really leave an impression on you when you're young that's just how we look at things.
Well, Scott, let me tell you one quick story. I have a student who teaches high school in Massachusetts, and he was talking to colleagues. He'd been reading some of our – he was in my graduate course, and we were doing some critical reading of the atomic bombing of Japan. And he talked to colleagues, and no fewer than 3 of them said to him some version of this. I used to think it was wrong that we nuked Japan, but I just saw this movie Unbroken, and now I'm beginning to think, you know, we had to do it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So there's that. And then to go back to
the It makes
sort of
you wonder. See, before, when they were against it, it was just because, well, whatever, I'm a liberal Democrat, and that's what we think now, or whatever. It wasn't because they had any good reasons. It's not because they actually believe in human rights, or they don't believe in anything. They just believe in, well, the people I fit in with are against it, so I guess I'm against it. And then I saw a movie, and that was the last argument I heard about it. So,
It can be discouraging. But
it is.
And, you know, the thing, you mentioned this this exhibit that had been planned 20 years ago, and this is 20 years ago, so my question I raised in this article is, have we come any closer? And I don't think we really have, to really taking seriously the impact of the bombs. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in 1995 was on the 50th anniversary of the nuclear bombs, was going to do this major, amazing exhibit, very ambitious. They were not only going to show the refurbished fuselage of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the first of the atomic bombs, but they were going to surround it by an important context and raise really important questions about, the decision to drop the bomb and its long-term legacies, how it was not only the last act of World War II, but really ushered in the age of nuclear arms and nuclear arms race and all the threat that posed. And they got creamed. A script of the exhibit got released by the Air Force Association, and critics lined up to attack it, so much so that they ended up canceling the exhibit. They did eventually just show the fuselage, but none of this surrounding context, which raised some of the questions that I've been raising about, you know, well, did you know that Eisenhower opposed it, things like that. The other thing I would just mention is that it wasn't just these conservatives that were attacking it, though they led the charge. Eventually, the United States Senate voted unanimously, bipartisan Democrats too, a resolution condemning the Smithsonian for its political correctness, for offending veterans of that war, and they should know better that the Enola Gay was part of the momentous effort to bring a merciful, they use this word in the resolution, a merciful ending to World War II and saving thousands of lives. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, as I say, at least 250,000 civilians were killed in those two bombs alone, never mind the rest of the war. And that, by the way, is more than two times the number of American troops that died in the entire Pacific War. I'm not discounting that momentous sacrifice of 108,000 or whatever it was, close to that, who died in the Pacific War. But we killed more than twice of that civilians with those two bombs alone. So I'd hardly refer to that as merciful.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sorry I'm keeping you a little bit over time into the top of the hour here, but I just want to point out that, you know, I had a great uncle who was a prisoner of war fighting. He was in the Canadian Army fighting for the British in the Pacific and was captured. And, you know, I don't know the entire details, but I'm certain that he did not have a good time being a captive of the Japanese over there.
The Japanese committed heinous war crimes for which they too need to apologize and haven't sufficiently apologized. So it's not, I'm not saying that, you know, we're the only guilty party here, but we could, you know, if we really are going to be an exceptional country, we should lead the way.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole thing. It's one of those kind of fake arguments. You know, in my Twitter fights over the nuking, well, you just don't understand the brutality of the Japanese. Oh, really? What? I just fell off the turnip truck yesterday. I never heard of the Japanese occupation of China or the Imperial Japanese or what they did to my own kin in that war. Yeah, you're right. I just have no idea. But it's just another one of those. Anything to change the subject from the actual vaporizing of the babies that were killed that day, which is what they don't want to discuss, is the real reality of the situation. Yep. Anyway, I will let you go. Thank you so much for coming back on the show and for writing this great article. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Scott.
All right, Joe. Oops. I always do that. That's Christian Appy. He is the author of American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. And he wrote this thing for tomdispatch.com. And it's running at antiwar.com under Tom Engelhardt's name there as well. And it is called Our Merciful Ending to the Good War: How Patriotism Means Never Having to Say You're Sorry, a.k.a. America's Hiroshima and Nagasaki 70 years later. And we'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. Senator Schumer announces he will oppose the Iran deal. Bastard. You know, I don't like Chuck Schumer. Never did. You know, first time I ever heard of Chuck Schumer was when I saw Waco, The Rules of Engagement, a Mike McNulty joint. And I thought, I hate this son of a bitch. Argh. God dang Charles Schumer. And then you know what happened after that? They made him a senator. Here's the worst human ever to be in the House of Representatives ever. And I'm including going back to the days to some crazy-ass slave torturers. Okay, maybe he wasn't the worst person ever in the U.S. House of Representatives. But here's this horrible, freaking, stinking human being, Charles Schumer. And they promoted him from the House to the Senate. And I remember thinking, no, please, bring back Al D'Amato. Anything but that. Not that. Not Chuck Schumer. So,
What happened was, now he's in line to be the majority leader of the Senate. No, strike that. The minority leader of the Senate. The Republicans control the Senate. But still, the leader of the damned Democrats, after Harry Reid's out. There are some Democrats now talking about challenging him for that. We'll see what happens. Now, there's a tiny bit of possible good news here, and I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. And I don't really read James Fallows very much, so I don't know how often he's right about things. James Fallows wrote a thing at The Atlantic that said, hey man, if Chuck Schumer does this, it's because he's counted the votes and he knows that it's safe and that the president will get his way anyway. You know, that's a political thing. That ain't conspiracy theory stuff. That happens in politics a lot. People wait till it's certain that they can vote no and it'll still pass, and then they vote no because they want it to look that way, even though it's really the other way. Maybe trade a vote with somebody else for something else. So Fallows is saying, Chuck Schumer's not going to stab the president in the back and really kill the deal. He's just going to look like he's stabbing the president in the back and vote against the deal, but the president's going to still win anyway, or at least that would... must be Charles Schumer's calculus. God, I hate it when they call it that. In fact, I don't know if Fallows even use that term. Sorry. Just DC people use that. Anyway, so the point is that, yeah, I don't know, man. Then again, maybe he really is going to do everything he can to try to kill the deal. One of his aides leaked out, or supposedly a reporter, a legit journalist said that, and a single source, but a Schumer aide told him he's going to vote to override the veto, too. And I believe I saw another quote where he said that he's going to, do what he can to convince other Democratic senators to change their mind and vote against the thing with him. And now, so if that's true and he's really saying that, then, man, that's the thing. And I'm not sure why. Well, I guess, I don't know. I did see a headline, but honestly, it was the real news, and that means it was a video interview, and I just didn't have the time for it. But the headline is worth analysis itself. It was whoever they were interviewing was making the case that Netanyahu's interest here is domestic politics inside Israel, and never mind international politics. Obama will be gone. Israel will have a perfectly fine, from their point of view, relationship with the next president, whoever it is, and so it doesn't matter. But what does matter is he has a one-vote majority in the Knesset holding his government up. And so he has to do this to hold his coalition together so that he can maintain power there in Israel. That's, you know, obviously the implication there. That's what he's worried about. So, that may be the overriding concern here over anything else. But... Man, I think it looks really bad when the president himself, I mean, I actually appreciate this. Don't get me wrong. This is the silver lining of the whole thing to me. I'm just saying from their point of view, doesn't it look like they're really screwing up? The Israelis and the Israel lobby putting everything they can on the line, not just to try to start a war like they did with Syria 2 years ago, but to stop a de facto peace deal when there's no other interest group in America other than the Israelis and the Israel Firsters who are against this deal. They can't even come up with an argument that doesn't begin with Israel. They don't have anything. What is supposed to cost America's national interest from this? Well, they'll give some money to Hezbollah. So what? I'm from Texas. And anyway, as Sahimi explained on the show yesterday, Mohammed Sahimi, they only give, you know, $10 million a year, where a couple of $10 million a year to Hezbollah. They're not about to give them, you know, whatever, you know, heavy equipment they even have. Bunch of truck-towed artillery from 1965. Anyway. Seems like they're really as Philip Weiss is saying here, Obama tells Americans, it's an abrogation of my constitutional duty to defer to Israel on the Iran deal. Who wants to end the Iran deal, says the president, asks the president. And then he answers, the Israel lobby. The same people who lied us into war with Iraq. The same people who said war with Iraq would be awesome. The very same people. And yes, representing the very same foreign power. And I read this thing this morning on the tablet talking about how anti-Semitic this all is. And I mean, what does he do? What is he supposed to do? He's supposed to say, now listen, I know logging interests in Washington State are doing everything they can to stop this deal. Even though that's not who's trying to stop the deal. It's the Israeli government and their fifth column in Washington, D.C. that's trying to stop the deal. How else do you define it? And no, they're not all Jewish. In fact, as Mondo Weiss will repeatedly remind you, most American Jews support the deal. The vast majority of American Jews, super majorities of American Jews, are Democrats, and they back President Obama, and especially on this peace deal. And in fact, I bet if you asked them, they'd tell you that they think it's good for Israel. And they'd be right if they said that. If you think doing what Netanyahu thinks is right is what's good for Israel, then you're a stupid idiot. This guy is driving that country into the ground. I love Pat Buchanan's article today. Pat Buchanan's article today is like, man, if Ike Eisenhower is here, here's what he'd do. He would say, you know what? You can try to talk about the next arms package with the next president, but I don't take kindly to a satellite state of our empire meddling in our foreign affairs. And then that's it. His government would fall the next day. If Ike Eisenhower is here, he would not take one bit of this. And, of course, Pat, you know, nostalgia for Ike. But anyway, how in the world can a foreign government interfere in America's domestic politics to this degree? It's amazing. And then you watch TV, CNN is even worse than Fox, I think, for the amount of attention they pay to it. And they go, up next, another person representing the interests of Israel to tell us why, oh, but when? And just watch them. They don't even pretend that there's a threat to America. Only Ted Cruz and Frank Gaffney pull out the EMP crap. That somehow this deal amounts to giving Iran a nuke. And then with one nuke, they could turn out all of our lights and make us all die, even though, no, that's stupid. All right. And let me mention again, Robert Kelly, former chief of the inspectors of the IAEA, an American. And he is the author of this article at loblog.com called The Parchin Puzzle. And it's debunking all the accusations that the Iranians were testing an explosives chamber in order to practice detonating an implosion nuke at this military base at Parchin. It's not true. In fact, the lies don't even make any sense when you take them at face value. And here Robert Kelly destroys the myth for you at loblog.com, The Parchin Puzzle. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys. Oh, man. I really wish this show was still 3 hours. I just never have enough time, but yeah, it's a hell of a thing. Fitz in the chat room's talking about Rand, how bad he sucks on all this stuff. Lying again in the Iran deal, about the Iran deal last night, saying all the sanctions get lifted before any verifiable restraint of Iran's nuclear program. Give me a break. Who's dumb enough to believe that? Who's dumb enough to believe that we believe that? Only people who want to believe that will believe that. But anybody who knows better is going to be pissed. And anyway, Scott McConnell wrote, "Oh, what a relief it is. Surely it's," he says it very eloquently. He's a great writer. Something like, "Surely it is a relief to no longer have to hope that Rand Paul will, in this context, lead the Republican Party out of this abyss." He's talking about their militarism and imperialism. And he says, surely he was not up to the task. So, in other words, once he came out against the Iran deal, Scott McConnell was like, okay, that's it. Finally, forget it. I don't have to worry about maybe you'll be good on anything ever again. Just go away. It's a relief. And I swear to you, man, I am. I'm Charlie Brown in the football here. As much I've hated Rand Paul before any of you guys, man. I interviewed him before anybody'd ever heard of him. The first interview, I went, and man, boy, did people get pissed off at me on the Facebook back then when I was on Facebook back in 2009, saying, I'm sorry, dude, this guy is a bum. I don't like him. He's bad on Afghanistan. He's bad on Guantanamo. He's bad on prosecuting torturers. He's bad on, I forgot, a couple other things. War crimes. No, these are political decisions. And And yet, look, he's Ron's son. I can't get over that fact either. And I can't, I've been, you know, as I've been explaining to you guys that, obviously his selling out is hurting him. His only chance to rally, look, this is America, okay? This ain't no democracy. It's an oligarchy. It's an evil empire at war, okay? So very powerful special interests pick the president, pick the nominee for that matter. The best chance he has, never mind of even getting the nomination, but of winning some primaries and doing some damage in a good way kind of thing, would be to rally millions of people to make them love him. Because the billionaires are not going to give him millions of dollars to do it. Because the billionaires are all a bunch of welfare whores, and they don't feel like messing around with anybody named Paul, no matter how bad he panders to them. They've already got Walker and Bush and whatever lined up. They don't need him. He's selling out to them, but they're not buying. What he needs is to tell the people of America, hey, here are our list of highest priorities. Don't you agree with me that we've got to stop doing the following things? Invading the Middle East, picking a fight with Russia, bailing out banks, destroying your freedom, right? Let's take care of that. Let's keep it simple. Let's make it as not just bipartisan, but transpartisan as possible. Hey, all Americans, last chance for the Bill of Rights. Last chance to bring the troops home and keep them home. But no, hey, look at me. I'm much more loyal to the Republican Party than Donald Trump is. Look at me, guys. Teacher, I'm tattletaling on him. He says that he might not support whoever gets in. I love the Republican Party establishment. Instead of, and of course, I got accused last night of defending Trump for pointing out that Rand was attacking Trump as the guard dog of the party, keeping the outsider out, instead of positioning himself on the outside and saying, I'm the one who's right about everything, and all these guys agree and are wrong. Like I put it in my talking point I tried to give him on Tom Wood's blog, with the exception of Donald Trump, the rest of these guys were bad on Iraq, and that's what started all this. Blah, 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 down the chain of dominoes that fell down, right? And which is not to praise Trump, just to acknowledge the truth and to show that he's a Paul. He's an outsider. He's an American people. He's not a Washington, D.C. He's not a GOP. He's not one of them. He's a human. He's an American. He's against them. No, no. He lines up with Mitch McConnell and all the National Review to say, to be, and in Trump's first answer, Paul interrupts. And again, Trump is a fascist, and the guy who accused me of loving Trump, I guess, couldn't look at my timeline where 6 minutes before I had just called him a demagogue and a racist and a warmonger and a, I didn't say fascist because I didn't want to oversimplify, an economic protectionist and probably a psychopath, but otherwise he's okay, was what I just said about the guy. But anyway, Rand, he's just... And I can't, I think even now I can't help it. I'm going to have to watch the rest of these debates. Maybe he's going to finally say something right about something. Anyway, sorry. What a waste of a radio show. Talking about Rand Paul. I'd rather bang my head into a stone wall. July is the deadliest month of 2015 for police-related killings. It's 700 and something so far. This one, the guy tried to run away. They shot him with a taser while he was climbing up this rock wall. He fell and hit his head. He's laying there dying. And there was a witness, a 12-year-old boy was there. It was like at the Family Dollar store. And the mother said, "I know CPR. Let me try to give him CPR." And the police wouldn't let her give the guy CPR. And he died right there on the spot. Well, the cops didn't give him CPR either. They just stood around hoping he died. So he could mount his head on a wall. The mother said she tried to perform CPR, but police wouldn't let her. So I feel like if someone was here to perform CPR, they should allow her to do that. Yeah, well, that's because you're a human being, not a government employee, obviously. By the way, here's a nightmare. It's not quite police nationalization, but it's headed the wrong way. Federal agents to embed with Baltimore homicide cops to quell unprecedented violence. No, we need to enforce our rights from the bottom up instead of turning to our greatest enemy, to mankind's greatest enemy, the U.S. national government. Great write-up, in case you missed it, in the New York Times about this guy, Lewinsky. William Lewinsky, training officers to shoot first, and he will answer questions later. Makes a living excusing murderer cops as a professional defense witness for any cop who ever gets actually attempted prosecuted for killing somebody. This guy will go and explain to the jury why he never had any choice ever, no matter what. And when you read that article and get the nuts and bolts of it, you're going to be pissed off. I wish Anonymous or some vigilante would, I don't know, hack his credit card number and put it online or whatever stupid crap they do to people. Whatever. I wish he would fall down and bump his knee really hard on something. That's what I wish. Here's one. Hawaiian Gardens man ran from deputies before fatal shot, wife says. A homeless couple squatting in a house. The cops showed up. He ran in the backyard unarmed. They killed him. I don't even think that they lied and said that he tried to attack them. He suffered a gunshot wound. Yeah, the cops shot him to death. Oh, and then there's the cops that shot the kid twice in the back for sitting in a car with a girl who was being stung on a pot deal. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Okay, guys, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. Wrapping up today with Scott Paul from Oxfam. And they have this media briefing. Yemen struggling to break the fast. Welcome to the show, Scott. How are you?
Doing okay. Thanks for having me on the show, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. So let's see. I guess basic background, as you say in here, Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen for about 4 months now. According to the Wall Street Journal, it's American spies and military men are controlling the airspace and picking the targets. It's really an American kind of proxy war there, bombing the Houthis in an attempt to reinstall the last dictator, Hadi. And so now you guys are talking about the humanitarian impact here, and I think it's been, if the war's been 4 months, it's been at least, you know, three and a half months since we first were told, at least by Patrick Coburn, if not others,
that the Yemenis import as much as 90% of their food, and that under this blockade and war, we can only expect them to start starving to death basically immediately unless something is done to end this conflict. Is that about right?
Yeah, that we couldn't agree more on that part of that ending the conflict. You know, Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. It has been for a long time. Even before this stage of the conflict began, it had the second highest malnutrition rates in the world. Since coalition-led airstrikes began towards the end of March, the conflict has only escalated. And since then only, we've seen about 1.3 million people displaced within Yemen. And the numbers are really staggering, and they don't even do justice to the nightmare that people are living in. There's now 21.1 million people in need of urgent humanitarian assistance to survive. That's about a bit more than 4 out of every 5 people in the country. So a ceasefire and a political solution can't come soon enough.
Okay, now, so now when it comes to whatever local crops, I mean, somebody's got to be growing something. I know we're talking about the Arabian Peninsula here, but, I mean, is it really right? 80, 90% of their food is imported? It's kind of amazing that the population was able to grow that much beyond what food that they can grow themselves would provide. You know, it's the magic of markets, but I guess it does leave them very vulnerable at the end.
It does.
In a crisis like this.
It is a staggering statistic. And Yemen is relying on imports, not just to meet its food needs, but also to meet its fuel needs. And that's been a double whammy. It's been a 1-2 punch because what food is produced within the country, just as what little food is able to be imported, if there's not fuel to move it around, people aren't able to access it.
Right.
So, this, as you said, it's a country that's immensely vulnerable to outside pressure. And it's now been effectively isolated from the international community and from its trading partners, with whom it's had historically a very close relationship.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing about this, though. So we're 4 months on, and I don't know. Do you have numbers for how many people you estimate have already died of hunger or starvation or you know, malnutrition and I guess, you know, whatever diseases that hit along with that level of weakness that gets lumped in with, you know, basically you could call it starved to death already. And how many more? I mean, it seems like if their markets are completely shut down, their imports are completely shut down, the war continues to rage, so many millions of them are on the brink of starvation. They can only be on the brink for so long before they actually starve. I mean, what kind of window of opportunity do we have to save these people's lives here?
Well, the window is already closing. It's tough to track exactly who is starving to death per se, but malnutrition has been simmering in Yemen for a long time, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. Since this stage of the fighting began, at least 4,000 people, and we estimate it's much higher, but at least 4,000 people have died just from the violence alone, over half of those being civilians. And again, we think it's more than that. There's been almost 20,000 people who've been injured from that violence. And it's, when you have these staggering malnutrition rates, coupled with hospitals that aren't working, with people who, by and large, are only able to access unclean and unsafe drinking water, you get an incredibly high risk of disease, that could go from 0 to 60 in about 2 seconds. And that's really what we're most concerned about, is this combination, this lethal cocktail of violence, malnutrition, disease, and other impacts of this lack of sanitation and water distribution. You know,
yeah.
I've had colleagues tell me they walk through some of these devastated cities in Yemen, and it's like a scene out of Blade Runner. You have piles of garbage on either side of the street, just festering, and there's no fuel for local authorities to pick it up and move it somewhere where it's not going to be infecting people. So it's the combination of all of these factors that's really most worrying.
Yeah. Well, and Matthew Akins was on the show, snuck into the country through the blockade across the Red Sea, got into Yemen and went and reported from the northern province there, right there adjacent to the Saudi border, and, you know, basically describe it. I don't mean to put words in his mouth. I forget exactly, you know, what he called it, but he basically described a place that looked like the pictures of the Gaza Strip after the war last year,
of just, you know, Europe after the after World War II ended, those pictures of Germany we see or whatever, the place is just devastated, where they clearly, well, again, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but I think it was pretty clear that it was indiscriminate bombing here, not, you know, oops, we accidentally hit, you know, these civilian targets, but let's just take out this neighborhood and that neighborhood.
Yeah, Sadat governorate in the far north is the one that's probably suffering most of all. About 80% of its people are going hungry right now, and 50% are in critical at a critical level in terms of food security. They've also had to deal with some of the most devastating airstrikes. And it's interesting that, you know, he said he has, you know, he concludes that it's indiscriminate because, you know, we're not an investigative agency. We're there to provide humanitarian assistance. And so, you know, it's difficult for us to draw legal conclusions about who's bombing indiscriminately or who's targeting civilian infrastructure. But the level of destruction is just jaw-dropping. And I think there's, you know, it's easy to make that inference when you look at the hundreds of civilian sites that have been damaged through the airstrikes and through the ground fighting as well since this stage of the conflict started. You know, you have hospitals, schools, religious centers, bridges and main roads, and collectively what it all means is that people aren't able to get the basic services that they need, even from aid agencies that are there and able to deliver some help, because you know, they need to at least be able to leave their homes in a safe way and go to a place that's a little bit safer or go to a place where services are being carried out.
Mm-hmm. Man, and then, you know, the bad news, of course, is that the former government backed by the Saudis is now making headway in the port town of Aden, and they brought in, I don't know how many, but very many tanks from the United Arab Emirates, and so they look like they're just starting the next phase of the war here. It is not their intent on putting Hadi back on the throne in Sana'a, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, all of the parties at the moment are taking a maximalist position. Everyone from the Saudis to the armed groups on the ground, each of them with their own interests, and other players in the region who now have been involved militarily. We've seen a really startling uptick over the past half a year or so of arms going into Yemen and going to parties that are fighting in Yemen. And the result of all of that is that what had been a set of political grievances and political disagreements have now crystallized and hardened into sort of deeply entrenched military conflict. And it's in everyone's interest in Yemen for these parties to put down their arms and agree on a political solution that's inclusive of all of the different groups that have an interest there.
Yeah.
And at the same time, none of them are willing to give up on their dreams of total control and imposition of their authority.
Right. All right. Well, can you stay one more segment with us here?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to.
Okay, great. Hang tight right there, everybody. It is Scott Paul from Oxfam. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Wrapping up for the week here. Talking with Scott Paul from Oxfam. We're talking about the Saudi-American war in Yemen. It's Saudi planes, but it's, of course, the Americans are the ones running the entire air traffic control and everything, picking the targets, according to the Wall Street Journal. So it belongs to us. But, Scott, I think part of the problem, part of the effect, you can characterize it as a problem or not, I guess, part of the effect of having it a kind of halfway outsourced war means there's much less attention paid to it. It's not being considered an American war. Obviously, it's really hard for reporters to even get in there past the blockade like Matthew Akins did. There's very little journalism coming out of there, very little incentive, I guess, for especially American reporters to even cover the thing.
I wonder if anybody even noticed when you guys put this report out. I mean, you could watch CNN for a week and not even know there's a war in Yemen at all.
Absolutely.
Oh, and of course, I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button. You're going to have to start that answer over.
It's quite all right. Can you hear me, Scott?
Yeah, you're on.
Yeah, I think you're spot on that the difficulties that journalists have had getting into the country has really limited the ability of organizations like ours to spotlight just how much people are suffering. The journalist you had on sounds like he managed to get in. Great, you know, great job to him. But when we put reports out like this, our goal is to really spotlight just how much people are suffering, and also what needs to be done to bring this conflict to an end and to end that suffering. There's a lot of individual journalists, I think, who are very interested in this, but since people can't go, can't take pictures, see just how horrible the situation is, can't talk to individuals who were affected quite as much, there's a limited resonance. So it's important that you know, you've invited me onto the show, and that other journalists continue to pay attention to this as it goes on. But you're absolutely right. It's funny. You mentioned this is it's an American-owned war. Inside Yemen, a lot of people think of this as a Saudi-American conflict, and the U.S. role in this conflict has been really confused. On one hand, the U.S. has talked very vocally about the need for a political solution. President Obama, in fact, called the King of Saudi Arabia, King Salman, and had a conversation about the need for political solutions. And at the same time, it's been reported that U.S. military personnel are coordinating on operations, offering logistical and intelligence support, and of course, selling massive quantities of arms to Saudi Arabia. And I think what we would want to see is we would want the U.S. to make itself very clear that when we say political solution is needed, it means we're not going to support one of the parties to the conflict anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's as simple as that. America is the 800-pound gorilla in this situation, especially concerning the Saudis. Call the king, tell him it's over, it's over. Simple as that. And all that has to mean is, hey, I'm ordering the AWACS back to their bases, so sorry, right? That's the end of that.
They'll say they have limited influence, and it's certainly the Saudis that are doing a lot of the heavy lifting in this military operation, according to public reports, but the U.S. has a lot of leverage with a close ally. To hear U.S. policymakers say that they want political solutions while they're heavily arming and supporting one of the parties to a conflict is pretty disingenuous and disjointed. It rings hollow for me, and I think to a lot of people in Yemen.
Yeah, afraid so. Now, so I know, or I guess I don't know, but I assume you guys are doing some lobbying here, right? Part of your staff, their assignment is to take this report to Washington, D.C., try to get a congressman or a State Department official to acknowledge it, to talk with you guys about it, a little something like that. Am I right?
That's what we do. We have a lot of different pieces to our mandate. First and foremost, we deliver assistance to the people who need it most, and that's our goal, is to reduce suffering. But we also see ourselves as a campaigning organization, and our view is, our goal there is to use our mouthpiece to promote justice and to end that suffering. So we distribute that report in Washington as well as in capitals around the world.
That's cool. And forgive me, I don't know too much about Oxfam, but you don't do the HRW amnesty thing where every once in a while you support a regime change like in Libya Oh, look, a war for humanitarian purposes. We're buying it. That kind of thing. You guys don't do that, do you?
You know, I can't think of an instance where we supported regime change. We're an impartial organization. And so our aim is to prevent suffering.
Cool. That's what they say, too. But, you know, sometimes it's not so consistent.
Yeah. Unlike a lot of humanitarian organizations, sometimes we do speak out in favor of or in opposition to use of force in a specific situation. But it has to be an extraordinary situation for us to support the use of force, and it would have to be very, very specifically devoted to protecting civilians. And we'd have to have confidence that people on the ground want that and that it's reasonably likely to happen.
Well, I mean, that was the exact script. I mean, it was all lies, but that was the story for the Libya war in 2011, of course, that Amnesty jumped right on board with. But I guess you guys didn't. That wasn't quite good enough excuse for you, huh?
we didn't adopt that position. And here in Yemen, this is a case where it's very clear that that the military objective, if all the parties continue to pursue their military objectives, and you know, refuse to make some pretty common sense concessions that would end the suffering of 21.1 million people, that's unacceptable for us.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And now, so yeah, and back to Yemen and D.C., when you talk to the State Department, you get, do they give any indication to you guys that there's any kind of time limit on this thing, or, you know, onward to victory until Hadi rules the place again, or do they even answer you?
Well, I mean, the State Department view, and I'll do my best to give them the benefit of the doubt and to sort of reiterate their position. Their position is that Yemen is a country in transition, and the administration of President Hadi is one part of that transition. And that irrespective of all that, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has decided to conduct this military campaign to restore that transition, and they're going to support the effort to restore the transition. I think you can imagine what the exchanges would be like between Oxfam, an organization like Oxfam that believes we need an immediate permanent ceasefire to end the suffering of people in Yemen, and the State Department. But ultimately, that our views are falling on deaf ears at the moment. So I think there ought to be a very strong public awareness that this is a no-win situation. We've got a war in Yemen that's going on that's not really serving anyone's interest, and it's going to continue until someone finds some sense and agrees to start making some concessions for peace.
And you know what, man? I mean, this is a little bit beyond your mandate, I understand, but in this situation, it seems pretty clear that the Houthis, they bit off more than they can chew. They don't really want to rule Sana and the rest of the country. The Iranians, their friends, not their owners, advise them not to do it. And, you know, defending their own autonomy is one thing, but in other words, there is clearly room for negotiation here. You guys withdraw to there and we'll stop bombing you if you stop bombing us when we, you know, come to here and there and whatever, share power. I mean, in other words, there's nothing like a stalemate here. There's plenty of room for compromise set.
Yeah, you know, like I said, everyone is pursuing their maximalist military goals at the moment, when in reality there is a political deal to be had. One thing I think maybe worth pointing out is the UN Security Council has adopted one resolution over the past 4 months. And rather than insisting on a ceasefire, it's a resolution that was very one-sided and didn't really reflect the situation on the ground. It imposed a lot of conditions on one party, the Houthis, to abandon a lot of the positions they had taken up. And in reality, the Houthis had no incentive to do that at the time. So now we're in a position where other parties, like the Saudis and the coalition, are pointing to this resolution and saying, well, this has to happen before we make any concessions. Or, sure, we'll talk, but the talks have to be around how to implement these concessions that the international community has demanded of the Houthis.
Right.
And I think in order for peace to really take hold, in order for the parties to realign their incentives and end this conflict that's causing so much suffering, the Security Council needs to speak again and make clear that these conditions on the Houthis, they're not preconditions. They're not the exclusive objects of peace talks. They may be part of negotiations, but ultimately the international community's position has to be, we need a ceasefire. We need an opening of the sea, air, and land routes into Yemen that have much more potential than even our organization, organizations like ours, to reduce and relieve some of this suffering. We need to get back on a track towards a political solution.
Yep. All right, everybody. That is Scott Paul from Oxfam, sticking up for the people of Yemen. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
All right, y'all. That's it for the show. No show this Sunday because it's Fun Drive on KPFK, but I'll be back here Monday, noon to 2 Eastern time, 11 to 1 text time.